Thank you, Susie. Track 3. The Broad National Park. Is it working? Sebastian Oak examines the pros and cons of the Broad's controversial status as a national park.
They have been called Britain's green lungs, offering breathing space in complex lives. And as we now look to catch up on holidays, our national parks have perhaps never been more in the spotlight. There can be few people in Norfolk unfamiliar with our own member of the national park family, but it is worth reminding ourselves just what makes the Broads so special. Open water, tangled car or wet woodland, reed and sedge fens, and wide open grazing marshes make up the characteristic mosaic of the Broads. Its unmistakable identity draws too on the idyllic villages, old churches and iconic windmills, and of course, the traditional sailing wherries. Altogether, there are more than 125 miles of navigable waterway here, making the Broads a perfect place for boat users. But they share this space with some of nature's rarest species. You can spot crane, bittern, marsh harrier, rare plants such as milk parsley and fen orchid, and scarce invertebrates, including the Fenrafts spider, the Norfolk Hawker dragonfly, and, not least, the emblematic swallowtail butterfly. The Broads is a unique addition to Britain's 15-strong national park family, which more often than not represents rugged upland scenery rather than water-filled lowland. The Broads also came rather late on the scene, with the Broads Authority put on a statutory footing only in 1989, long after its equivalent bodies in the Lake District, the Peak District, or Dartmoor, for example. Actually, all of the British landscapes protected in this way count as relative newcomers in the big scheme of things, with the great-grandfather of all national parks being Yellowstone in the United States. Dating back to 1872, it grew out of growing conservation concern as the American West was rapidly colonized and developed. American national parks, though, are usually areas of true natural wilderness, by and large publicly owned and managed. People are subservient to nature. The British national parks are substantially different. After thousands of years of human integration into the landscape here, the UK lacks any significant areas of real wilderness. The mark of people has been left almost everywhere. And like anywhere else in Britain, the land is generally privately owned. But against that, we should remember that our own national parks often exist in their cherished state only because of human activity rather than despite it. Nowhere is this more true than in the Broads. Indeed, this cannot be said to be a natural landscape at all. The trademark shallow lakes were deliberately dug out in medieval times to supply peat for fuel. Over the centuries, water levels rose and the peat diggings became progressively flooded, and by the 14th century they were abandoned to morph into what we see today. The Broads Authority is charged with conserving and enhancing natural beauty, wildlife and cultural heritage, while promoting opportunities for public enjoyment. It also protects the interests of navigation. But can it do any of these jobs effectively when, unlike its American counterparts, it has little direct control over the land? Maybe it is time to ask the question of whether our system has delivered any real benefits. John Packman is the chief executive of the Broads Authority. Clearly this place means a lot to him. For me personally, he says, when I think about the Broads, the first thing that comes to mind is my wife and I kayaking along the River Waveney, Bure or Ant. I think about enjoying the wildlife, seeing the blue flash of the kingfisher, or the glimpse of an otter. It's part of being immersed in a beautiful and living landscape that all of us are able to enjoy. John points to many initiatives he feels have made a difference to people, places and nature in the Broads. Some of them stretch back to the early days of the Broads Authority in the late 1970s and 1980s, before it gained its full statutory powers. Chief among them is quite literally bringing the Broads back to life. By the 1970s, the gin-clear water of the Broads that was reported at the beginning of the 20th century had been replaced by a murky, muddy soup, he explains. And this had an adverse effect on fish stocks and other wildlife. Phosphates, a component of washing detergent and fertilizers, had led to blooms of algae, loss of light in the water column, and the decline of life. Early work between the Broads Authority and Anglian Water introduced phosphate stripping into sewage treatment plants to remove the nutrient. Then, a project with the University of East Anglia restored water quality and revived beneficial aquatic life, starting at Cockshute Broad and Barton Broad. The Broads was also essentially the birthplace of the agri-environment schemes that today help to ensure farming respects nature. Back in the 1980s, when the Halvergate grazing marshes were at threat from the plough, the Broads Authority set up the experimental Broads Grazing Marshes Conservation Scheme to encourage environmentally friendly farming. It became a model for agricultural support across Europe. Then there is the Authority's Water, Mills and Marshes Landscape Partnership, which reconnects local communities with the landscape through heritage and the arts. It encompasses projects including educational activities, repairing old drainage mills, and providing training opportunities for young people to learn heritage skills such as reed and sedge cutting for thatching. Maintenance of the waterways to keep them navigable is also judged a significant success. Every year, the Broads Authority removes tens of thousands of cubic meters of sediment from the waterways to maintain navigation, with the sediment reused to rebuild land lost to erosion and create stable banks while developing natural habitats for wildlife. But not everything the Broads Authority does attracts universal support. One area of controversy has struck at the very core of what the Broads area actually counts as. In truth, the Broads is something of a half-sister to other national parks. With a name to maintain navigable waterways, it is different in legal terms to other members of the family. Some argue it should not be called a national park at all, not least because, unlike in all our other national parks, conservation of the environment is not judged to be the thing of chief importance, the overriding aim that outtrumps all else. The so-called Sanford principle that says conservation should always come first, the very bedrock of the British national park system, is not applied in the Broads. For many years, the Broads perhaps struggled with its identity. Was it a national park or was it not? Finally, in 2015, matters were thrown to the wind, and the authority announced that it would henceforth brand itself as the Broads National Park for marketing purposes, even though others said it was fundamentally different to real national parks. The National Park brand is internationally recognised and hugely appealing to visitors, said John Packman at the time. It is shorthand for a place that is special, is properly looked after, and deserves to be valued by everyone who visits and lives there. Some clearly supported the decision. Greg Mumford of Richardson's Boating Holidays, the largest hire boat company in the Broads, says, "The National Park brand gives the Broads area a widely recognisable identity. As a tourism company, this allows us to clearly and effectively promote this most wonderful landscape. Since using the brand across all our media, we've seen an increase in visitor numbers." Others, though, were unimpressed. Among them was Tony Bennett, who works in radiology at the West Suffolk Hospital and is a keen recreational boat user. He says, "The Broads is not a national park and cannot be without primary legislation. Should the Broads become a proper national park, the concern is that the needs of conservation would be placed above the needs of anything else. That could well mean a worsening of facilities for recreational use, and possibly even the banning of boats and angling in some areas." He is not alone in his point of view. The Protect the Broads, We Are Not a National Park group on Facebook has over 900 members. Tim Harris also objects to the Broads calling itself a national park, but for a different reason. A rare breed livestock farmer and a strong voice for habitat restoration at Catfield Fen, he previously had an international career in shipping with P&O, during which he served as president of the British Chamber of Shipping. He believes the Broads Authority does not deserve the National Park label. "The authority calls itself a national park for PR purposes, when legally it is not one," he says. "And it has disowned the key feature of a real national park, that is the Sanford principle. This step symbolises where the authority finds itself today, effectively as a tourist board promoting the Broads as a tourist destination, but no longer taking leadership on conservation, which many think is necessary to ensure the long-term future of the unique ecosystem here for future generations." Steve Reed, however, is more supportive. He has sat on the Broads Local Access Forum for a number of years and has a motorboat and a sailing dinghy on Alton Broad. He says, "The creation of the Broads Authority has allowed a unique statutory body to focus entirely on the diverse needs of the area of the Broads, dealing with the conflicts between different interests. It is certainly not an easy task. It's probably been impossible for the authority to please everyone all the time. It is all a long way from the perhaps single, united vision behind the Yellowstone National Park. For British national parks, or any areas with similar status that may or may not count as a real national park, realism and compromise are part of the process. Where you think the fine line should be drawn within that process probably depends on your point of view."